Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good whatever time it is, wherever you are in the world. This is Malcolm Hawker. I'm the host of the CDO Matters podcast. And thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for being here today. I'm excited to talk about the dark arts of marketing. This conversation is going to be all about what you as a CDO or a data and analytics leader or a data professional may, or more intriguingly, may not know about what marketing organizations are doing with data in the marketing function, the fun stuff that marketers are doing, the problems that marketers are solving, that may sound actually very familiar to some of the problems that you as a data leader are solving. So my goal with this podcast today is to maybe shine a light on some stuff that may be happening in your marketing organization that you're not aware of. Maybe you are. And if you are, hey, that's great. But I suspect you probably aren't, given my experiences in traversing these worlds. So with that said, I couldn't be more excited to be joined today by Shubh Sinha. He is the CEO of Integral, who is playing an interesting role in this space. We'll talk a little bit later on about what Integral is doing. But Shubh, thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation today.
Right on. Me too. So let's talk a little bit about marketing and marketing data and what marketers are doing out there with data. And I'll start my question with a little bit of a story. I used to work. Oh, by the way, we didn't talk about this when we were doing our prep, but I used to work for this company called Neustar. Are you familiar yeah. with Neustar?
Very, very familiar.
Okay. So Neustar bought a company that was doing what's called onboarding. And do you remember who did they buy, Shubh?
I think my ad tech history fails me at the moment.
They bought an onboarding. Yeah.
Yeah.
They bought a company that competes with a company called LiveRamp. And you used to work at LiveRamp. So LiveRamp does what marketers call onboarding. And this company, my previous employer, a few lifetimes ago, Neustar, bought a company that did onboarding. And I'm like, I'm a data guy. And a classic data and analytics CDO data guy. And I'm like, onboarding? What is this onboarding thing? Tell me more. So Shubh, you tell me I was going to go into my definition, but what does onboarding mean to you from a marketing perspective?
Yeah, definitely. And this is one of those things when I got into ad tech, having no background in ad tech or MarTech, I realized people have their own definitions, but I think most simply, you know, the idea of onboarding is exactly what an onboard ramp is in the physical world. You take a set of data and you're trying to activate an ad or create an ad from that data and then send it to someone or a platform so that someone can see it. So, you know, an ad that you've seen on TV, an ad that you've seen online, that was onboarded via a digital ramp in a way. And the digital ramp is the company that was bought by Neustar, LiveRamp, and some others.
Oh, okay. So what I find interesting is just like even the lexicon, right? The words that are used to describe processes, like, so let's take the word activate. It's a very common word in the marketing world. And it's very common in a technology that I know reasonably well called CDPs, customer data platforms. And it's the idea that you take data and you operationalize it. Would you agree?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a customer record. I've got a record for Joe Smith and joesmith@gmail.com. And maybe you've got some address information about Joe Smith. Who knows? But I'm going to put the record for Joe Smith into Adobe so that Adobe can make informed decisions about how to target ads to Joe. Does that sound like a correct process? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's a good high level.
Well, but so even just the word activate, right? Like data people would be like, what's that? Right? Like I don't even use that word. Another thing that is interesting to me around this whole idea of onboarding, if you look at like classic onboarding, a lot of the processes there, let's take a you've got a file of information about your customers, right? And you want to onboard that, or you want to create a file that is ready for downstream consumption that you can activate, and you activate it in this onboarding process. A lot of the processes there, now this gets to what kind of Integral does in the space that Integral plays in, really would look familiar to most data people. But what are some of the details that go into onboarding? Is there integration? Is there some sort of matching? What's happening behind the scenes?
Definitely. And I think onboarding is one of those phenomenons or concepts that scales as you get more and more complicated or more and more nuanced in your strategy, right? And so you have super small companies that just have, you know, they have a CRM list that they want to target. And so they set out an ad based off of some sort of attribute in a data set. But I think as you get bigger, and especially what I saw at LiveRamp, where we worked with the Fortune 2000 and a lot of these large enterprises, you have teams, you have sub-teams, you have segmentations of different data sets. And so it gets quite complicated as to who am I targeting? How am I targeting them? Because I think fundamentally, just to zoom back up for a minute, I think the whole purpose of onboarding is to get some sort of message to somebody in a way that they understand. And so, you know, pharma historically is very famous for spending tons of money on TV ads because they typically cater to a population that watches TV. And it would not work the same way with like a D2C brand who typically targets online. And so the onboarding has to be somewhat tailored to the type of strategy you're running. And I think where you're getting at is as you get deeper and deeper into onboarding as a strategy, you start noticing, hey, how can I get these ads to people, or how can I get these messages to people in a way that's very tailored to them? And then you have this concept of data harmonization, which I'm sure the data folks know as well. But how do you have segments that are multifaceted? So not just email, not just phone number, but some blend of, and in a privacy safe way, of course, some blend of location mixed with demographic, geographic, like all these different segments together. And so I think as it gets more and more nuanced, and as you want to become more and more nuanced in your ad spend and your marketing spend, you start harmonizing different data sets together. And that's all a part of onboarding, because ultimately onboarding is activating a particular data set. And the result of that is some sort of messaging delivered to people like you and me. But you want to be bespoke and you want to be very specific, because ad dollars and marketing dollars are not cheap either. And so I think that's where onboarding gets a lot more complicated and nuanced, and why LiveRamp and others have built out product suites around onboarding, where, you know, could be a simple topic, but becomes quite convoluted very quickly.
Well, what about things like rules? So a nuancey way of what I just heard you say is that you can have very specific or customized rules for how you potentially harmonize data. So in my world, I would call that matching. But what you just described was maybe at a segment level, or maybe at an individual level, to the degree that you have the right to do that. Where do those rules live, and who decides what those rules are? Are they driven at a campaign level, and are they configured into a LiveRamp, or are they something that is done directly to the data? Like what's happening here?
Yeah, and I think it's actually configurable at a few different levels or a few different steps in the process. But I think at each point you have an intersection of user preferences. So in this case, a data scientist, let's say a data scientist preferences, and a data scientist working in a marketing org, for example. And so you have campaign configuration tools that are built into these large companies that allow you to only do certain things that are within conventional security policies, conventional privacy policies. But I think as you get more and more deep into your strategy, or as you get more and more complicated, you also start bringing in these very novel data sets. And so, you know, in my world, regulated data, which I'll define as data about people like you and me, or sourced from people like you and me, but is governed by HIPAA and CCPA. Not only is it configured at the campaign level, but almost at a stop before, when Integral gets involved, we ensure that the data set that is going to get loaded into a LiveRamp or loaded into a platform is itself compliant with different policies such as HIPAA or CCPA. And then you have another set of configurations at the campaign level to ensure that even if the data is technically compliant, you don't misuse it, or you have rules around potentially bad actors. And so I think what you're getting at is very, very accurate, where there's a ton of different safeguards in place. But I think what goes into it is a mix of, I, as a data scientist at a marketing org, what do I want? And then what can I do? And then there's multiple levels at which that either collides or harmonizes. And a big reason why we exist is because I think it collides a bunch. And so that's how I see it, where each step has a mix of user preferences as well as safeguards built into it.
So that's interesting. So the rules, you know, when I would say rules to a data person, generally they would assume that I was talking about kind of like data quality rules or the rules used to match. When you heard me say rules, you were talking more about kind of compliance and what you can and what you can't do with the data, which is an interesting twist in and of itself. Not saying that that's wrong. Obviously, you're a CEO of a company. It's obviously right for that use case. But here's just another example of kind of the differences, mm-hmm. the way that maybe traditional data people would look at things on an IT side, mm-hmm. and marketers would look at things. So let's take a trip in a time machine. I'll tell you a little story because I'm old. But I used to work for this internet startup called AOL, and the year was, I'll say, 1998, believe it or not. And we were just starting to target ads. And I managed a team of about 30 engineers that was responsible for doing ad targeting. And we had this problem in that we wanted to target directly to people, but we couldn't target directly to people. And we weren't even supposed to know who the people were, even though we could tie back to people in our customer file if we had to. So to solve this problem of not knowing who or kind of remaining kind of anonymous, what we did with our data, like millions and millions of rows of information about people that had PII in it, we shipped it off to this third party that did stuff to it, basically anonymized the data and gave it back to us so we could do everything that we wanted to it. And at that point, we would put them into very highly tailored segments, right? It wasn't me, but it was like awfully close to me, right? At a kind of a demographic, at a segment level. Well, is that still happening today? That process I just described, is that still happening?
Yeah. That is definitely a practice that is still pretty common today. And I would even say, or I would go a step further, I think as more and more, not that 1998 wasn't that long ago, so not that old. It was a while.
Thank you. You're very kind.
But I would say all those practices have gotten even more robust. And so what I mean by that is that third party you mentioned, you know, where in many ways we're a version of that third party, but just speaking about it objectively, the third parties have gotten a lot more well-versed in regulations. They've gotten a lot more well-versed in data analysis and data splicing and dicing. And so when you go out, or when someone in AOL's position sends out that data, it comes back a lot more tightly scoped from a regulation perspective. So, you know, you're clear and good to go. It also comes back more, I would say, tightly aligned with whatever the business goals were that were commensurate with that data set. And then the last part there, I think, is that audience, or what we'll say is like a lookalike in many ways, where maybe you don't target the exact person, but you target the people like them. Those technologies have also gotten better, especially in the age of AI, where, again, like it's getting close and it's producing copies of, but not targeting that person. Like that has become a standard practice because there's a way to now get there compliantly and from an accuracy perspective tightly, so that you can actually still do what you need to do as a company. But then the patient, or not the patient in this case, consumer, still gets the value of their privacy, but they also get tailored messages developed for them and then delivered to them. And I think we've seen that a little bit in consumer sentiment where, you know, of course, the classic, I hate ads and I hate marketing still appears, but you also see the other side of it where when people receive tailored messages about what they may or may not need, at least today, tomorrow, in the future, there's started to be more consumer sentiment that is more appreciative of that, rather than what I think used to happen, which was, you know, a little bit of a spray and pray. And even I, you know, I don't like ads in general, but I like the ones that are actually unique and catered to me because they can solve a problem at some level for me. And so I think the practices you mentioned are not only still here, but they've gotten more robust as to ensure that to a degree, everybody wins in a way.
But a lot of these, so first of all, what I described is pretty close to the core value prop of Integral, right? I mean, that's what you're doing is making sure that there is HIPAA compliance and GDPR compliance or whatever compliance that is kind of baked into the data that marketers generally marketers, maybe not entirely always marketers, but generally marketers are using, correct?
Correct. And just to take that a step further, to go back to your example, you mentioned you sent that data set out to a third party. I think yeah. where a, a better version of that third party where we're integrated with data providers as well as the end customers. So in this case, AOL, such that you could be sending data continuously as opposed to thinking about things as like, oh, this is my one-time kind of activation. As opposed to, you know, as data sets updated, refresh, all of that, your compliance stays in real time at the pace of your data. And so all this to say you're accurate on that compliant enablement, but we make sure that the base of that data is not only compliant, but has a lot of juice to squeeze when it goes downstream for some sort of lookalike analysis or for some sort of ad targeting.
Yeah. This may be a bit of an oddball question, and we're kind of maybe getting off the road here, but I'm sorry, my mind is spinning. If I'm somebody who wants to drop out, right? Like, you know, obviously it's don't just mindlessly keep on clicking yes to user agreements. But I guess, are there ways that I could effectively do that? Or is it, how would I like drop out and make sure that I'm not getting marketed to? And I'm making this too much about me, but I just find this a fascinating question because there are so many big agencies out there that have so much data, right? And how would you unwind that ball if you wanted to?
Yeah, definitely. And as a consumer whose data is out there as well, I can definitely relate to that. And so just to kind of hone in on that, it's a form of compliance. And I think compliance takes on so many meanings. And the thing that we're uniquely focused on is compliant data customization, meaning when that data is coming in, we ensure that whatever's in that data or whatever combinations of data come out of Integral, they have a very low risk, according to policy, of catching or like targeting someone like you and me, meaning like, you know, there's a sufficient level of obfuscation in the data set to where you can act on it as a company, but it's still safe to do so because the chance of picking one or, you know, two individuals is very, very low. And then that's one form of compliance. There's other infrastructure compliance companies that ensure that, you know, you have the right GCP modules, the right AWS infrastructure, all of that. So I'll call that like structural compliance. And I think what you're getting at is user-oriented compliance where,
yes,
you know, the data sets, opt-ins and opt-outs, those are typically managed at the onboarding platform. And so I know tons of companies that power that onboarding at the very end. It's almost like imagine like a toll booth or like a traffic guard. As that data is going out, if a user or a customer has opted out, they should have registered with the data broker, the onboarder, and in many times, because those are the ones who actually own the data assets to be able to take back, so to speak. And so on the way out to onboarding, the traffic cop, usually in the form of some sort of software at an onboarding destination, can take out or check what's been opted in, what's been opted out, so that data never leaves. Of course, the world is not perfect, so I'm sure there's still exceptions that occur. But typically, it's the onboarding destinations that have something on the website, or data brokers have something on their website that say opt out because recent legislation has required it.
Okay. So I would have to believe that given this is about compliance at an individual level, what we're talking about here is data related almost exclusively to people. Yes? Or are there other kind of data sets in your world that would maybe touch on other things like cars, maybe, or like what people own? Or is this all just really mostly just about data related to people?
Well, it's funny because those are in many ways the same thing. And so what I mean by that, if you think about me, I don't own a car, but let's just say I did. And I've lived in three different places. I'm from a small town in Tennessee. I've lived in San Francisco, and now I live in New York. And let's say I own a different car in each city, and I have all these different attributes about me, my income, my job, my prescriptions, all these different things that represent the life of Shub. So while my car inherently is not a data point about me, say it's like a red Ferrari in New York, maybe that's not so unique in New York, but like a red Ferrari in my small town in Tennessee, that's technically not data about me, but it's an attribute that can be pinned back to me, in which case it becomes a personal data point that we Integral consider as part of this identifiability analysis, which essentially is like, what's the odds of finding Shub in a data set? Because we want to ensure that Shub is sufficiently obfuscated at the individual level, but his cohort level characteristics can still be used for commercial distribution, R&D, et cetera. And so that's where car data in particular, not really a data set, usually comes about. That being said, we've processed tons and tons of ad and marketing related data sets, in which case users or people like us, consumers, have attributes like owns a car, owns a dog, here's the car, here's the dog, And those can become identifiable attributes, which then get factored into our compliance analysis or general compliance analysis, I should say.
How often in the marketing organizations you guys are working with are there data scientists?
So we typically come out of a data team's budget and we target a data scientist.
A marketing data team.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. Yeah, that's correct. And so, yeah, that's a very important nuance. Yeah. So we're typically coming out of a marketing data team's budget, and the stakeholders or users in our platform are typically stakeholders who have have skin in the game with regards to the marketing campaigns, the marketing analysis that's happening. And so it's a big intersection between data science driven thinking and positions, but under the context of a marketing driven goal, a set of goals.
So, I mean, ballpark, like most of the marketing analytics teams that you're working with have some form of data science. Is that would be fair?
Yeah. And just to give a little bit more color there, you know, we have three functions going, or three segments: enterprise, mid-market, and SMB, especially what you notice in the enterprise with, I'll just broadly call them the Fortune 2000. Tons and tons of data science influence in that process and data science stakeholders, just because that intersection is very, very strong. Yeah.
All right. So interesting. That's something that I wonder, you know, how often CDOs would be working with those data scientists, because data scientists are very obviously kind of at the nexus of the current craze around AI. How many conversations are you having around AI, and where would something like onboarding, where would something like what Integral does feed into a data science process?
Yeah, so we do have an AI segment to our business in the sense that
these are— I should say an AI process. Forgive me, I said data science process. We were just talking about that. An AI, specifically AI, not just classic data science, but AI. Apologies.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where I'll bifurcate AI native versus becoming AI enabled in a way. And so, you know, the Fortune 2000, they're not necessarily AI native. They've been around for a while before AI, they'll be around after, but they're using AI in their processes, and they have a distinct motion from some of the companies that we work with that weren't even around 2 or 3 years ago and have, you know, they've become very critical, and they've even just become possible after some of the recent advancements by some of the learning models that I'm sure we're all familiar with. And what I notice in the, I'll say AI native companies, so the ones that have just started up in the last 2-3 years, their data science function is ingrained from the beginning. And so even if I don't have a data scientist on the call with me, that data science nomenclature, the concerns, the goals, is just kind of baked into that process. Because, I mean, a lot of AI, it boils down to a set of inputs that are an equation of sorts. And one of the most substantial inputs is data science. And fidelity, which could also be known as quality, the source of the data itself, the quantity of, like, it's great to get data, but can we get more and more of it? Can compliance stay in real time with model iteration speed? That's something that we are very focused on. Like, these models want to train and guzzle up tons and tons of data, but you have to ensure that you're not bogged down by compliance timelines to get to product innovation. So those are a lot of the conversations we have there. And then on the other side of companies that are larger, but have AI initiatives, you know, they're bringing in data scientists in droves to make sure that they can achieve something along the lines of like an AI native feeling of, hey, data science is always here. But there's a very active, deliberate, and explicit call out, hey, like, what is the fidelity of this data? How much more of it can we get? Because especially for these large Fortune 2000, the juice has to be worth the squeeze, as opposed to it being experimental, but worth it for some of these bigger startups. So that's where you see a little bit of the contrast. But data science is still, as you said, at the nexus of a lot of the driving behavior.
So of these marketing organizations that you're working with, are you getting insights into some of the bigger headaches that CMOs have got related to their data? And if so, what would be like the top three headaches that a CMO would have about their data, right? In your conversations, are they concerned about, you know, lack of integration across systems? Are they concerned about the fidelity, quality? Are they concerned about cost? What are some of the things that are, from a data perspective, that are keeping CMOs up at night?
Yeah, and just to kind of root this all, you know, a chief marketing officer is responsible for boosting sales through targeted messaging. And so, you know, I think maybe what gets lost is that there's some real pressure associated with that role, because you're using an action to try and influence what is effectively another department, but, you know, there should be harmony between them. And so just kind of thinking about that, a lot of the tools at a CMO's disposal should result in very tailored messaging, tailored data in order to speak to people like you and me. So we'll go purchase a product or a service and you know, boost numbers. And so what that means though, is that how do you personalize at scale, or how do you tailor at scale? Because it's not enough of a win just to get, you know, a few people. It's also, you know, you can't just spray and pray the budget either. It's like somewhere in between, right? You have to have some nuance there. And so why I'm going through all this is because working backwards from that base, what we've noticed are, you know, speed of data enablement. So sometimes you get good data, sometimes you get bad data, sometimes you don't find out until the end. But that speed, if it's taking you 10 weeks to find out you got a bad data set, that is just lost time that's never going to come back. You'd rather find out in a day, right? And so a big value proposition for Integral is that we're a replacement to consultants who take a long time, and we can help you understand the time to value, or get the time to value for your data down way, way fast, like way, way lesser than what it is today. And so I'll call it speed of data enablement. The other one is data fidelity. So, you know, specifically in our world where you're leveraging regulated consumer data, which is typically a gold mine of information, if you go through standard compliance processes, you might lose half your data set. But again, you don't know that until a few weeks later. And so, but you have to work with it because it's the best you have. And so fidelity of data, you know, you can think about it like if you put in $10 million worth of data and you get 50% of it back, you just lost $5 million right off the bat before you even went out to go spend that ad budget. And so, you know, one is like, I'll call it like data fidelity, data quality, maybe, which I think is probably super familiar to the data stakeholders of this podcast. And then for the last one, I'll say data harmonization is a big one, or data experimentation, maybe is another way to say it. People like you and me, we're increasingly getting more multifaceted. Consumer data sharing is growing 25% year over year. And so as a CMO, your job is to understand each dimension of a person at scale so that when you combine them and deliver something tailored, you know, it digests well for people like you and me, but in a way that we understand. And so data harmonization is a big problem because you don't, like, you have to be testing data sets constantly, and you have to work with data vendors. And it's this huge collaboration challenge, as well as this huge data burden that you have to take on. And so, you know, Integral is kind of poised for all of them, but we've noticed those are the challenges that even I noticed at LiveRamp when I was in between all these different companies, and what really drove us to start the company.
So that's interesting. Again, I think that those three would also be keeping CDOs up at night, but they wouldn't describe them that way, right? Like what you describe, kind of, you know, you're using the term fidelity, which I think seems to loosely align to quality, or maybe effectiveness. Right. But so data quality is certainly keeping CDOs up at night. You know, data integration and matching, you're certainly keeping them up at night. What you're calling harmonization, right? Which is Joe Smith, Joseph Smith, J.M. Smith. How do we tie all those things together? Do you agree that's what you mean by harmonization? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I'll go even one step further to say that those attributes for like a Joe and a Joseph, you know, it's people like you and me. We're dynamic, and so we do change our name, or we go by a different name, and that means we also have maybe potentially different behaviors associated with that other name, and so it becomes a real, real deep challenge at scale, and so. All this to say, you're right. It just becomes a lot wider of a problem in terms of imagining a data set, in which case reconciliation or harmonization becomes even more challenging.
Well, so let's drill down on that just a little bit. We were talking about cars. What if one data set says it's a Ford and the other one says it's a BMW? Are there any tools out there in a marketer's tool belt to deal with that today? If so, what do they do?
There's not a, I'll call it a silver bullet. There's not a silver bullet today. And that's why even multi-billion dollar public companies like the one I used to work for, LiveRamp, they have a multitude of solutions for this, because unless you go up to that, you know, let's say Joe in this case, and ask them, you know, what's the right answer, which is of course not feasible, you have to end up figuring it out through the other data points available. And so if Joe has a BMW in Tennessee, if Joseph has a Ford in California, and then Joe has a BMW in New York, let's just say, I mean, on its face, it's possible that, you know, he has a BMW twice. He probably drove a Ford at some point, and that data point got logged, but maybe it was a rental. And so thinking about just like human level reasoning, then the next solution, or the next step down there, is from a technology perspective, how many different data sets can I leverage to establish a source of truth or a benchmark that I can consider as a source of truth, and then check against that? And so it might seem like guessing and checking the whole time, but the idea is to form this spine that you can measure against, such that in this case, maybe it's, I have high confidence because he had a BMW twice within 3 years. He probably didn't buy another car just for a year. And so it's probably accurate based off this corpus of source of truth data that I've established. But what you're saying is a real challenge. And that's why, you know, for us, like we see as this neutral compliance entity, we see all data passing through the ecosystem. And so that allows us to have this corpus more at the ready or more constructed, whereas other companies, they have it deconstructed and they put it together on a case-by-case basis. So there's no one-step solution yet for this.
All right. Opportunity for you entrepreneurs out there. How do you do MDM at scale for marketing use cases? That's the problem. Because doing this onesie-twosie is easy, but doing it at scale at a transactional level is really hard. And you actually described it. You use the word establish a spine. And I actually kind of, I like that metaphor. In my world, we would say create a reference set, right? Something that you know is the source of truth and you can bounce something against and check it against, yes or no. That's a way to do harmonization at reasonably well at scale if you're confident in what you've established as the gold master. If you're not, and if you're having to match pairs of records against each other across, you know, billions of rows in milliseconds, forget about it. You're not going to do it. But you will be able to do the kind of check against the master. I find this fascinating. Just different words for the same thing. You talked about like, hey, we'll go try this. We'll go try this. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the phrase that you gave. When it comes to effectiveness, when it comes to measuring effectiveness of these data sets, or maybe even measuring the effectiveness that something that Integral will do. How is a marketer doing that? Are they executing campaigns and then saying, okay, well, I got a 5% bump, then the data must be good? Or are they getting down at a data level and saying, okay, I know this one individual data, or are they doing A/B testing? What are they doing to measure value within the marketing organizations of this data?
Yeah, and the answer there is it's a multi-layered approach. I think you hit on some of the layers, right? And so if you think about most of the customers that we work with in the Fortune 2000, they have data budgets that under the marketing org, of course, they have data budgets to go out and purchase third-party data sets to integrate with their first-party data set or to combine in order to create a rich data set to then go act off of for marketing purposes. And so, you know, right off the bat, as soon as you purchase a data set, you have an ROI clock that starts ticking because data is, of course, not free. And so, you know, in this multi-layered approach, you have one, okay, I purchased $10 million worth of data. After compliance, how much of my data is left? Because not inherently what you purchase is not necessarily compliant. It has to go through the process. So right off the bat, you say with consultants, you lose approximately 50%. So you're now down to 5 million in terms of your what you've lost and then what you have. In which case, then you go in for data quality checks and your data scientists, they're also not free. And so they're also factored into the ROI analysis here of, is my data scientist having to deal with messy consumer data, or did it come in neatly packaged? In which case we can start finding insights and doing segmentations immediately to say, oh, I want to target dog owners, car owners, et cetera. And so there's almost like a data activation effort in a way. And you can measure that through how many data scientists are having to be involved in cleaning up the data. And then I think, you know, the third step here is the actual campaign costs and campaign calibration where, okay, I saw that this, you know, this campaign in the Southeast boosted sales by 5%, which, you know, amazing that attribution exists, in which case then you kind of wrap around this whole ROI and you say, was my data purchase, was my data activation effort, and was the boost on sales, you know, did this all align to be net positive ROI? Or is that 5% actually, you know, it took too much to get there and the 5% is not even worth it anymore? It's like those are the types of discussions where you have a multi-layered approach as to the ROI. But then, of course, you have distinct orgs responsible for each step. And so I'm sure the 5% boost in sales, like that org is probably very, very happy because that is a pretty exceptional boost there.
Well, for a Fortune 2000, 5%, absolutely. Right. Like when you're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars marketing budgets per quarter. Yeah, 5% is absolutely meaningful. That would be phenomenal. I mean, to me, the key takeaway there is that we'll never ever get to full causality. And you know, probably a bit of a fool's errand to say, yes, this $1 spent on this one marketing thing actually drove $1 in sales. But marketers are doing this. I know they're doing this. I know that they are doing attribution. Mm-hmm. They're doing campaign effectiveness. They're doing ROI. So the message there to CDOs is if marketers are doing this, so can you. All right. I find all of this fascinating. I could probably keep talking for hours about the uniqueness of marketing organizations, but some of my key takeaways just from this conversation, some of the things that CDOs are doing all day, every day, managing for data quality, they're doing MDM, they're doing matching, right? They're building pipelines. They're doing integrations. They're taking data from multiple places, putting it into one place and applying some rules to it to get clarity on who are my customers or my suppliers or my assets. Marketers are doing the exact same thing. They may not be using the same technology. They may be using different words, but they're doing some of the exact same thing. So I would invite you, my data friends, to go have lunch with somebody in your marketing organization and ask them what their data headaches are and ask them how maybe you could help. I don't know if you can. I think you probably can. And there's probably opportunities for the CDO organization and the CMO organization to work a little bit closer on some of these things, particularly the AI stuff. Shub, it's been awesome. I'm going to go and look up more words. I was, I did the deep dive on onboarding and activation, but I need to figure out fidelity a little bit more and maybe start spicing some of the stuff into the things that I post on LinkedIn. Thank you so much, Shub, for sharing your knowledge. What's the best way for people to stay in touch with you and to connect with you and to learn more about what Integral does?
Yeah, and thank you for having me. I mean, this was a great conversation that I think intertwined a few different threads that I think are going to be very meaningful for the data world and the marketing world, which in my world, there are many of they're the same in many ways because we serve both. But for staying in touch and whatnot, of course, my LinkedIn for my personal profile, as well as like following our company page, Integral, because what we are doing is intersecting data and marketing and many more use cases to come. I'm pretty open on LinkedIn in terms of the content that we post, and like I'm always looking to connect with new people. And so if there's a message you want to send, please send it. I would be happy to chat.
Awesome. Well, best of luck. Continue with Integral. Thank you again for joining, Shub. It's been awesome. To our listeners, our subscribers, our followers, thank you for tuning into another episode of the CDO Matters podcast. Hey, if you've got a topic you want to learn more about, if you've got a topic that you would want me to be speaking about, if you've got somebody that you think that I should be talking to on the CDO Matters podcast, DM me on LinkedIn. I am open. I would love to always hear ideas about people we should be talking to, because my goal here is to spread the word and is to spread knowledge. So don't be afraid to reach out. Thanks for listening. We will see you on another episode of CDO Matters sometime very soon. Thanks all. Bye for now.